year or so ago, in an interview, you told somebody, Lord Russell, that you felt that Europe could no longer produce great men, that perhaps the Africans will and can in the future. What did you mean?
Well, I meant that they come to it fresh. It happens to nations that are brought freshly into contact with higher civilization that they approach it with a freshness that the old civilization has lost. It happened in the time of the Renaissance. Civilization spread from Italy to France and England and produced very great results there. It happens in India. It happens wherever you get a new contact, that the old civilization is able to hand on something, just as the Byzantines handed it on to the Italians. The Byzantine civilization was pretty dead, but the Italians who came in contact with it made it very much alive again. And so I think it's very likely that the Negro races, who are not played out artistically, will do much better things than we are now capable of doing.
I see. What about your conviction that all the official moralists are preaching crimes against the human race? By that you mean they're going along with nuclear testing and nuclear weapons? Is that the point?
Yes, well, it all is connected with power. People are engaged in a power contest. Thus, internally, the contest between different parties, except in a totalitarian state. Externally, the conflict between different states. And the politician inevitably gets a power mentality. And you can't run a world that has nuclear weapons, a world that has an advanced technical science. You can't run such a world if power is the thing that inspires statesmen. It's got to be something else. It's got to be cooperation, because conflicts of power are now deadly.
Do you see anyone but the scientists speaking out? Do you see any preachers? Do you see educators? Are there exceptions to the official moralists preaching crimes against humanity?
Well, you see, the scientist isn't listened to. I learned that through the Pugwash conference. I had great hopes of getting the scientists together, and I got them together, and they made admirable pronouncements. Not a single newspaper mentioned it, not one, and nobody knows about it. And I found that the scientists, although they could do science, they hadn't got the art of popular publicity, which is a quite different art from science, very different. I've had to try to learn both, but it's an awful job.
It is a bad job. I wanted to ask you whether, if in fact, your own civil disobedience campaign here in England against nuclear weapons doesn't stem from a very logical thing that you pointed out, that at the Nuremberg trials and the trial of Eichmann, the men were indicted and found guilty because they obeyed the establishment. Their defense was, we were obeying orders.
Yes, and I think if we had a rational government in any of the great countries, the previous governors would be punished for the orders that they'd given, and some people would be punished for obeying those orders. I think that to obey an order to construct a weapon which, by the pressing a button, can destroy 200 million people is wicked. And I think a man who consents to do it is a criminal. But at present, he's not punished by the law. He's only punished by the law if he doesn't do it.
He's hailed. You had many theories and wrote books about education. And I understand that you have now come to a conviction that there should be, in education, a segregation according to intellect.
Oh, I think there should be, yes. I think that's a point where democracy leads people astray. Democracy is supposed to imply that all men are equal. I think all it does imply is that all men have equal rights. But it's absurd to say that all men are equal in ability, and any educator knows that that isn't so. Some of his pupils are clever and some are stupid. And it's a great mistake to teach the clever and the stupid together, because either you go so fast that the stupid don't understand anything, or you go so slowly that the clever are bored stiff. They need a different tempo.
The clever ones should be with the clever ones, and yes, the stupid ones with the stupid ones.
Yes, if you're going to have teaching in class.
Mm-hmm.
Because otherwise you go too slow for one and too fast for the other.
You receive many letters from Americans, and to what purpose are they writing?
Oh, I'm receiving enormous numbers of letters from America. I think half my post comes from America.
And to what effect? Applauding your effort?
Well, yes, the people who write to me nowadays mostly write favorably. It used not to be so, but nowadays they mostly write favorably.
They mostly favor your position.
Yes.
You said that the populace in general doesn't like intelligence. It's apt to go against their prejudices.
Yes.
Comment on that, Logan.
Any man who is standing for Parliament or be standing for Congress in your country, if he's a very intelligent man, he's almost bound to hold some opinions that would absolutely damn him in the eyes of the public. Almost bound to. And so he will keep rather dark about those things. And he won't always succeed in concealing his intelligence. I think it often happens that a man is a failure in politics because the public sees that he's intelligent.
That often happens, you think?
Yes.
You think it's happening a good deal in England today? In the United States?
Oh, it happens everywhere.
What about this hatred of the Russian, or political hatred?
Oh, yes. Well, now, that's a very important subject. There is, certainly in America, and to a lesser degree in Western Europe, a kind of a feeling that Russians are different from the rest of mankind, and that they're wicked. Now, that, of course, is quite absurd. One set of men is much the same as another set of men. And if you could meet, we will say, a crowd of Russian children coming out of school, and you wouldn't know they were Russians, they would be exactly like a crowd of English children or American children or French children or Italian children or any other children coming out of school. And you wouldn't see the slightest difference. They would enjoy running and jumping and shouting and playing. And they would have the same pleasures and the same pains. Exactly the same. There's no difference. And if you saw an old man sitting in the sun and enjoying the idleness that he'd never been able to enjoy before, he'd be just the same whether he was Russian or whether he was American. And the whole idea that people differ racially, I think, is just a mistake. And it's a mistake that stems from undue importance attached to politics. Now, you know, it was Karl Marx who invented the idea that politics is all important. And I'm sorry to say that a great many people who execrate his memory have taken on this one dictum from him. And they think because they don't like Russian politics, they must hate Russians. And that just comes of overestimating politics, which is, after all, only a part of life, and perhaps not the most important part.
What does one do to diminish the hatred temperature? What does one do to diminish this political hatred?
Well, travel will do it a great deal. I mean, I think American tourists who've been to Russia on these tourist shows they have come home thinking much more friendly feelings towards the Russians than they had before, because they've seen that just like anybody else.
You feel the cultural exchanges are an important contribution in this area?
Yes, to some degree, but what I think more important is the purely human things, to see that they like food, and they like play, and they like sitting in the sun, and purely human things, that the sort of human basis of their life is just the same.
I see. We must pause at this point again, very briefly. We'll be right back with it. Well, Russell, which of your many and almost unlistable contributions, your many contributions in so many fields, are you most proud? What gives you the greatest satisfaction?
Well, I suppose I ought to say Principia Mathematica, in which I was half author. I suppose that's the most important thing I've done, unless, of course, this present anti-nuclear campaign were to succeed. In that case, that would be the most important thing.
Well, which of the pursuits, philosophy, logic, or literature, have you enjoyed the most? Is the answer still the same, logic, mathematics?
I had a certain job that I wanted to do in regard to mathematical logic. And I did that job, and after that I didn't want to go on with mathematical logic. I felt I'd made my contribution, and I would leave the further development of the subject to other people. Gradually I've become less and less scientific and more literary. But I think that's not by deliberate intention, it's just so happened.
I wonder what you feel like on this matter. I heard a record in which you did a quite remarkable interview with a man, and you said that nothing in your life ever terrified you as much as meeting Prime Minister Gladstone.
Oh, yes.
Why?
Well, I was...
When was he Prime Minister?
He was Prime Minister in 1892 to 1893. And that was the last time he was Prime Minister often before. But it was at that time it was a little earlier than that, really. I was a very shy boy. I was 17, and you were pathologically shy in those days. And he came to spend the weekend with my people. And after dinner, I was the only male in the family, and I was left tête-à-tête with him when the ladies retired after dinner, as was the custom in those days. And I was ready to sink through the earth with fright.
Was he given to harsh words, or what did he do?
He didn't do anything to make me happier, no. He complained that they'd given him port in a claret glass, and I didn't feel that I could say anything about that.
I wonder also, in the same interview you mentioned that you thought that the most important literary influences on your life were John Stuart Mill and Shelley.
Yes, I think that's true, yes.
Why?
Well, John Stuart Mill, he was a friend of my parents, and I didn't know him through that because my parents died when I was quite tiny. But nevertheless, it made me know he existed. And so I read his books. And they were the sort of books that would appeal to me. They were empiricist and liberal and humane. And I liked him very much. And Shelley appealed to me from his hatred of tyranny. And also from his very vivid sense of beauty, natural beauty in every kind of beauty. And I thought he sort of portrayed a lovely world of imagination.
Lord Russell, you had some difficult, trying experiences in the United States in your lifetime, specifically in the city of New York, and at, I think, CCNY, wasn't it, the university?
Yes.
Do you bear any grudge? Do you feel bitter about that? How do you view it in retrospect?
I don't think I bear a personal grudge. I do think it's a pity that the chief city of a great country should have its government so completely in the hands of illiberal bigots. I think that's a pity. That I think that's not a personal feeling.
No. Do you think it's mitigated somewhat? Do you imagine that if you were to go back to the United States in 1960?
No, I don't think it would be any different. They might have me on a different subject. They would have me now for being a communist. But it would come to the same thing.
You think there's been no greater tolerance, no greater
compassion? I don't think so, no.
That's a sad comment on us, isn't it?
Well, there are a great many things that are very, very nice in America. I think that Americans in personal relations are very kindly, much more kindly in personal relations than English people are. I mean, in England, if you come into a gathering where you don't know people, you may be left severely alone and nobody to talk to. In America, they certainly take pains that you had someone to talk to. In those sort of ways, I think Americans are more kindly than English people.
Well, being a rebel in America is probably as difficult, but is it any more difficult than being a rebel in England?
Oh, yes, much more difficult to be a rebel in America than a rebel in England, because the whole civilization is more harsh. The penalties are greater. I mean, just look at me, how very slight are the penalties that I have to endure.
You went to prison just
yes,
a few months ago.
Only for a week.
At 90 years of age, going to prison for a week is an acute hardship.
Oh, no. But in America, a man loses his livelihood, his wife and his children starve. I mean, the penalties are infinitely greater.
Yes, in some cases they are. Is being called a communist in this country as potentially disastrous as it is in the United States?
No, not nearly. And in any case, it isn't so freely applied. Because, you see, we're used to the Labour Party, and everybody who has the opinions that the Labour Party has, whether of the right or the left, would in America be called a communist.
The charge is recklessly employed, that's true. I wonder, a good deal of your difficulty in the United States came not from your political convictions, but from your theories of education and sexual relations.
Yes, the trouble I had in New York in 1940 was entirely on moral grounds. They thought I was an immoral person. They said I was lewd, lecherous, lascivious, and obscene. And this was upheld in the law courts.
That's ridiculous. That's ridiculous. Did you challenge? Did you slash back?
And
legal terms.
They didn't know, you know, that I'd ever written on anything except sex. I was very much interested to find that Parsons didn't know that I ever wrote on anything except sex. Because they're also sex obsessed. Nothing else interests them.
Why is America so sex-obsessed?
Oh, because of a rather harsh moral system, which most of them, of course, don't give up to. And the only way they can seem to live up to it is by proclaiming their extreme virtue.
If one, you preach, for example, if I recall, in Marriage and Morals, you suggest that an occasional infidelity, if all other factors in the marriage are fine, can be lived with, need not cause marital explosions and so forth. You also thought that premarital relations were in order and made sense.
Yes.
And that caused, I think, your main trouble.
Now, you see, both those things are common in American life. Only you mustn't say so.
Are they equally common in England?
Yeah, I think so, yes.
Is there less hypocrisy here?
I think they've become equally common in England. They weren't originally, but they are now, I think, just about the same. Only you mustn't say so.
In other words, what you object to is the hypocrisy.
Yes.
Of preaching something and practicing something else.
Yes, I object to the humbug. I don't like humbug.
Do you see any diminishing of humbug, or is it rampant?
I don't know.
In England, do you get more tolerance for... Well, your courts are much more difficult. Your libel laws are much more difficult.
Yes, the libel laws are much stricter here. I don't know. It depends, you see, from what the issue is. On some issues, I suppose they might be stricter here. But on the things they call moral issues, I don't think they would be as strict as they are in those parts of America which are dominated by Catholics.
I notice a peculiar difference between our two countries. When a rebel rears his head in America, he is frequently slapped about,
yes,
and rendered, or the attempt is made to render him impotent and ineffective. When an intelligent, exciting rebel rears his head in England, the establishment invariably sucks him up, buys him, wants,
yes,
him, makes him part of themselves.
They're much cleverer dealing with potential rebels. They soften them up.
Soften them up and then absorb them.
Yes.
And make them peers.
Yes.
I mean, there are labor leaders that began as firebrands who wound,
yes,
up in the House of Lords, haven't they?
Yes. It's a much cleverer technique.
You recommend it?
No.
No. We pause again, Lord Russell, for just a brief moment. Lord Russell, is it true that you taught George Bernard Shaw how to ride a bicycle?
What is true?
Did you teach George Bernard Shaw how to ride a bicycle?
No, well, not exactly, no. What happened was this. He had just learned more or less to ride a bicycle. And I went out for a country ride with him. And at the bottom of a steep hill, the road forked, and I didn't know which way to go, and Shaw was behind me, and I got off my bicycle to ask which way I should go. And he wasn't able to manage his machine, and he ran slap into my bicycle. My bicycle buckled. He was precipitated 20 feet through the air and landed on his back on a hard road. He got up, his bicycle undamaged, rode home. I had to go home by train.
Shaw triumphed again. You knew Alfred Lord Tennyson, I believe, didn't you?
Oh, I used to know Lord Tennyson quite well, yes. We were more or less neighbors in the country.
What sort of a fellow was he?
Oh, I didn't like him at all. He had a very fine Italian cloak, and he used to wrap it round himself. And he had very long hair, and he would stride over the country, seeing nobody. And, I mean, how many of his friends he met, he wouldn't see them. And he was always being the poet, very much.
How about Robert Browning? Was he...
Robert Browning was quite a different type. He was awfully at home in an old lady's tea party. He was sort of mild, and, well, you perhaps know Max Beerbohm's caricature of him.
Yes,
he had always a very fine top hat, which he put down upside down, and he was very smooth. It's odd, because his verse is not smooth, but his talk was very. The first time I met Browning, I was 2 years old. He came to lunch with my people, and he talked the whole time without stopping, and they got awfully bored. And at last I piped up and said, I wish that man would stop talking. And that's the first time I met him.
Lord Russell, I believe that you had the unique opportunity in 1920 of meeting Lennon and talking with him. What was your impression of him?
My impression was not so good as I'd rather thought it would be. I, of course, realized that he had immense strength of will and integrity, in the sense that I think all his public acts were dictated by something that he really believed to be for the public good. But his defects, as they struck me, were two. One, that he was very narrowly orthodox in his adherence to Marx. If he wanted to prove a point, he thought it enough to quote a text of Marx. No fundamentalist was ever more addicted to scripture than he was to Marx. And I thought that seemed to me rather narrow. The other thing I didn't like about him was that he was quite clearly rather cruel. In both these respects, I thought he resembled Oliver Cromwell. In fact, I thought he might be a reincarnation of Oliver Cromwell.